Beyond Us and Them, podcast on radicalization in the times of social polarization. Welcome in the podcast of Resilience Through Education for Democratic Citizenship Project, shortly RedE. My name is Filip Pazderski, and we continue the discussion about how social polarization leads to radicalization, threatening our democracies, and how we can counter these challenges. And today we have with us Markus Pausch, who is working as a political scientist and professor at the University of Applied Sciences in Salzburg, where he teaches social work, what is important for us and what will be important for us today. And he's also a consultant for European universities, cities, regions and organizations, and also an associate member of the UNESCO Chair in Prevention of Radicalization and Violent Extremism. Hello, Markus. Nice to see you.
Hello, Philip. Nice to meet you.
Yes, and nice to have you with us today. Thank you for making this time. So maybe for the beginning, if we can start with discussing the main concept of social polarization, if you can elaborate a bit how you understand it, why you think it's an important issue nowadays, and so on and so forth.
Okay. Yes, I think polarization indeed is something that is very characteristic for our societies today. We are looking especially at the European situation, but it is a phenomenon that goes beyond Europe, that probably concerns the whole world. But if we take into consideration mainly the European context, then I think we can see that two consensus or two agreements of the post-war period are today under pressure or in question. And these are on the one side, or on the one hand, the democratic consensus, and on the other one, the European consensus. So I think after 1945, and then for Central and Eastern European countries after 1989, there was a broad consensus about the democracy or representative democracy as the only game in town. So it was clear that all the countries after the Second World War and then after the fall of the Berlin Wall oriented towards representative democracy. Of course, there have always been some people questioning this, but there was nevertheless a large consensus about the about democracy. And the second consensus was about European integration. So in almost all European countries after 1945 or 1989, there was a consensus on the fact that the European integration process is a good thing and that membership is a good thing in general, with all criticisms that existed, of course, but nevertheless, and with a few exceptions of, you know, Switzerland or Norway, who didn't want to join. But the big majority of European countries and of European elites and of European citizens agreed on democracy and agreed on the European integration process with all the nuances in the debate. And since quite a time now, I would say since maybe the end of the 1990s or so, or maybe with some differences in different countries, but at least or especially with the beginning of the crisis era that we are facing, I would say with the beginning of 2008, the Lehman Brothers, the Euro crisis and so on, the two consensus or agreements are more and more in question. And we know the example of heads of governments declaring the end of liberal democracy or so, promoting a kind of illiberal democracy. And we also know that the European Union was confronted with the first country to leave in its history with the Brexit. So, and this is something that polarizes in Europe. So there is a polarized discussion about the future of Europe and the polarized discussion about democracy, or at least about the way democracy should work. And this has to do, I think, with the crisis that we are facing. It's an ongoing crisis with acute or very tremendous crisis in a long crisis that we knew or have been knowing now since more than 10 years. And of course, all these things are even more polarized when refugees are coming to Europe, when a pandemic breaks out.
And I also understand that this social polarization that we are observing all around us, caused by all these factors and trends that you just briefly described, but it also causes something that we focus at in our project, in RADAR project, which is social radicalization, actually. Yeah. So if we can get to this point, and if you can say maybe how both trends, phenomena are connected, and if you can explain also how you understand this social radicalization process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe I should first explain what I would understand under polarization, because I didn't give this answer to your first question. So polarization mm-hmm. is a process where opinions are very polarized, and where groups are forming who are not willing to discuss with each other anymore. So if you have a spectrum of opinions, these opinions are going from the center to the extremes, to the poles. And in a polarization process, it is staged. If you don't have points of consensus anymore, then mm-hmm. The two groups will end up in stopping the dialogue, stopping the debate. And so this is polarization. And polarization, I think, is a very broad phenomenon. It has to do with the whole society. It means that the center, or those people who are in their opinions more in the center, that mm-hmm. they are pulled to the poles. And even though if there is still quite a large number of people who do not have extreme positions, they are not heard anymore, or they are not heard in the real percentage they would represent. Mm-hmm. So in polarization processes, we mainly hear in the public debate the extreme positions. Mm-hmm. And this again strengthens the polarization, because people in the middle, they believe that they are in a minority position, and they have the feeling that they need to join the one or the other group. Mm-hmm. So this is what I would call a polarization process. Mm-hmm. And within this polarization, radicalization is one thing that is, of course, going hand in hand with that. Mm-hmm. Not in all the groups, but again, if you have this spectra of opinions, and many people go further to the poles, then this is also combined with a kind of radicalization in thinking about an issue, and in thinking about ideologies, in thinking about the political opponents, who more and more are considered to be adversaries. And if the radicalization process goes on and on, then at least some people might end up in radical groups where violence is considered a legitimate way to act. And this is, I think, radicalization is a process that can end up in violence.
Mm-hmm. And is this element of violence also an important aspect of radicalization? Or because, I mean, I'm asking about that because in our public discourse, also in my country, Poland, I mean, journalists or commentators quite often say that somebody or something is radical, which, yeah. I mean, we know that it's not the same as the phenomenon that we are discussing here today. So maybe if you can somehow maybe explain what are the differences and how we can actually create a definition, a better definition of the social radicalization itself.
Yeah. Yeah, it's I think it's a very sensitive field because there is a war with words, we can say, a kind of struggle between different ideologies or different worldviews, and it is very easy to call the opponent a radical person in order to delegitimate his or her position. So we have to be very, very sensitive with these words, and we shouldn't see radicalism or radicalization as something that always is necessarily ending up in violence, because this is not the case. And also polarization processes, to a certain extent, are part of our pluralist societies, and our democracies also need a kind of polarized debate in some respect. Because if you think about the history of democracy, then we will always find that whenever a group of people wanted to get voting rights, for example, then a polarization process was inevitable. The voting rights for women, for example, are a good example for polarization processes. Or let's take the ecological movements from today. Fridays for Future polarizes. That's absolutely clear. But that doesn't mean that it is dangerous. To a certain extent, we have to accept that opinions that polarize can also be a motor or a vehicle for the development of our democracies, for an improvement of our democracies, for the protection of human rights, or for the protection of our climate or of our ecological situation. But the point where the tipping point is where people really deny, or where people stop to accept dialogue as the main mean in a democracy, and when people want to eliminate other opinions, when they want to maybe even physically eliminate the opponents, then it is a problem. And it is very sensitive and not always easy to know where this tipping point is. It is not always clearly to observe. But if we look at the polarization processes in our times with COVID and so on and so on, we all know that there are the COVID deniers or people who don't believe that this pandemic really exists, and many other people who criticize governments for their measures. And it would be very dangerous to say that all of these people are radicals or are ready to use violence, but parts of them are, I think, and that's where we need to be very clear in our analysis, in order not to put all those who have an opinion that might be radical in a way into one group and say they are radical, they are dangerous or violent. I think again that the decisive thing is, is a person or a group still in dialogue, in debate, or is this group already on a way where they don't want to talk to others anymore, and maybe in some cases even use violence?
Thank you very much for making this very vital point that social polarization is not necessarily always a negative phenomenon, and actually it's sometimes even needed in the democracy. But as I understand, when we will move to social radicalization, it's not the case anymore, that it's rather a negative phenomena again. So if we can move to this topic, and if you maybe can explain a bit us how it manifests itself in, especially in your country, in Austria, because I mean you're you're an insider, yeah, in this society.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, radicalization, as we use it in our projects and in democracy research, I would say, would always mean a way that ends up in violent extremism. So again, here that we have a discussion also about this term of radicalism or radicalization, because in authoritarian systems, very often the Democrats are called the radicals. And if you take the history of democracy, then you will find that the radicals were very often those who wanted to have their political rights and who criticized the authorities. And still, until today, there is, for example, in political theory, there is the radical democratic theory. So you can also be a radical Democrat, and then I would say then it would not be dangerous for democracy. In the radicalization research that we are talking about or that we are focusing on, we distinguish several stages of the radicalization process, and we say that, well, a person can have radical opinions on any issue. Yeah, you can be a radical non-smoker, for example, or you can be a radical, I don't know, fan of a football club or so. This can be in your mind, and this can be your opinion. And when it comes to discussions on smoking or on the football clubs, then you can be radical also in the expression of this opinion. But that still doesn't mean that you would be ready to use violence. So this is a first stage where I would say it's not so problematic. But then in the radicalization process, it goes further to a situation where you say, well, I am radical in this respect, and I don't accept any other opinions on that. And I want to make my opinion win over other opinions. And that's the point where it's getting political. So in a political debate, you say, well, I have this opinion that might be radical, and I want to make it the important mainstream opinion. That's what I'm trying to do. That is still something that can be very normal in a democracy. On the next stage, however, people are more or less locking up in their radical world. So they look for others, or they are recruited by others who have similar opinions, who are similarly radical, and they step by step, they lose contact to the rest of the world. So they, what we would call a bubble in the online media, in the online world, for example, that could be also used, that word, for this stage of the radicalization process, so that people surround themselves only with people who have the same opinions. Mm-hmm. They leave the other world, and when young people are observed in their radicalization processes, then the experts always say that, well, if a youngster leaves school, for example, or if the youngster leaves his club or his association where he or she was active, or when this person quits the job, for example, then then it's already a dangerous signal, because this would mean that this person is only moving in its own, in his or her own world anymore. Mm-hmm. And then the last phase would be the physical violence or the readiness to use violence, and then also at the last stage, the use of violence.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and if we can have a look for a moment on your country, on Austria, yes. If you can explain us how this process looks like in your country, if it is somehow different than in other countries, in other parts of Europe, or maybe there are other many similarities as well.
Yeah, so I think to a certain extent Austria is similar and comparable to many other countries. That means that we have a polarization process and radicalization process around the topic of either cosmopolitan views or nationalist views in their extreme forms. So, but we know that mainly this nationalist idea of different groups and political parties attracts people who radicalize. And this is in Austria definitely a phenomenon that we can find on the far right side with different movements and political parties in this direction. And we can also, as it is the case in other European countries, find radical jihadists, for example. So in Vienna in November, there was a big terrorist attack from a jihadist who killed people in Vienna. And we have a long tradition of far-right extremism, I would say, that has its roots back in the history with National Socialism, of course, and some groups and some ideas, of course, survived over time, and then young people were recruited and got into that, and then there were some lone wolves, as they are called in the in extremism research, like in the 1990s, a terrorist called Franz Fuchs, who killed several people and injured many others. He was a single person. His networks were not very clear until today. We don't really know all about his networks. What I want to say is that these networks always existed to a certain extent. So far right authoritarian extremist groups. And this is something that is maybe more important in Austria than in other countries. In general, a similar situation, but with this special tradition of far-right extremism that we have in Austria.
Since you, as you said, you had some long tradition of this kind of behavior or trends in Austria as well, I was wondering if you maybe can share with us some insights about the fact if you were able in Austria to develop some interesting, effective ways how to counteract this kind of behavior, especially social radicalization, yeah, and that you think that it's really interesting to be shared and explained to other people.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think we have to distinguish between different levels of the political decision making and of policy. And if we look at these different levels, then we will find the federal level, that is, of course, the most important in terms of competences and laws. And there is, some effort on this level to act and to observe different phenomena, different kinds of extremism, of anti-Semitism, and so on. But nevertheless, we have to admit that the prejudice and the arguments that are used by these extremist groups are at least partly also addressed or used by populist politicians who sometimes even have governmental responsibilities. And so on this federal level, it's a little bit difficult to act if you have populist or far-right groups in governmental responsibilities. Then they are, of course, less interested to observe in detail what is happening there. And then you might have a bias on certain kinds of extremism and maybe be blind or at least not so clear with other groups. So what is more interesting and more effective, I would say, is what is happening on the levels below the federal level, on the regional level and on the local levels, because there is the place where people are recruited. There is the place where people go to the streets. So mayors and city administrations or the authorities, local authorities or regional authorities are very often more interested and more effective in counteracting these phenomena. So what is done in concrete terms? There are different, of course, departments in the bigger cities who deal with these things, mainly in Vienna. So there are different departments of the city dealing with these problems, and they are trying to use the public space for organizing dialogue. They are in parts of Vienna, they are trying to have kind of participatory budgeting in other ways of inclusion of citizens. They have good programs with social workers to bring people into the public debate and to help them to articulate, to help them to say their opinions and to empower people from different backgrounds, from maybe underprivileged groups. And this is, of course, already something that is very important, because very often extremists or people who radicalize, very often young people from a background with sometimes a little perspective or left behind. And so it's very important to give perspectives to these youngsters to avoid that they get into these groups and that they can be recruited by these very professional recruiters, because all these extremist groups, they have their recruiters. They know what they do. They know how to address, how to approach young people and how to manipulate them. So projects of social inclusion, of participation, of dialogue, bringing together different groups, that's happening on the local and regional level mainly, and on the federal level, it's more the work of the security authorities, I would say.
Okay, and what role should social workers play in this whole process? Because, as I said in the introduction, you are working in this area, dealing with the preparation of future social workers at your university. That makes you the perfect person to explain to us what role social workers, in particular, can play in countering radicalization. And perhaps you are able to illustrate this for us with examples of actions that are already taken.
Yeah, a first important thing is that social workers are trusted by the young people. So trust is crucial. And for example, teachers have another role. So they are also very, very important, and they're very important in education for democratic culture and so on. And they can do a lot about that. They can also build trustful relationships with their pupils, but it is not their first aim to do so. And they cannot, beyond the classroom, they cannot have this trustful relationship with youngsters very often that social workers can have and usually have. So social workers have the first advantage that in a normal situation, they have time to develop trust between themselves and the youngsters they are working with. There is, for example, a slogan that I heard yesterday again in the conference saying it is a kind of unexpected kindness that young people are experiencing, in the best case, from social workers. So I would say it would be good that these youngsters, even if they do something that is not considered a very social behavior or so. So even if they are provocative and maybe rebellious, if they are treated with kindness, then very often for them this is something unexpected, because they are used to be the outsiders or the problem kids or so. So social work can start with this idea, and I mean, I would say almost all the social workers that I know, they are definitely kind to their young people. This is an important starting point. And then, of course, there needs to be a discussion or a debate about what they need, what they experience, for example, in terms of discrimination, or what they need in terms of participation, or what they need in terms of being heard by authorities and the public. That's where social workers can, in a first stage, listen to these demands and impressions, and then they can show young people ways to express themselves. And this can be organized, as I said before, in very concrete terms. But social workers in that respect definitely need the support of the local authorities, because otherwise they don't have a budget and they don't have the resources to organize something. But this can be, for example, done by competitions to in creative creative ways, like rap, to make a competition, or it needn't be a competition. It can also be a festival that is, for example, invites young people to write or compose about a certain topic, rap versions or poetry slams or whatever, but something that is that has to do with their youth culture. So it shouldn't be an intellectual text that is asked from them, but something that they can perform easily. And this is just one example. Then there are intergenerational talks, for example, that can be organized, where people from higher age groups meet with youngsters in a youth center, for example, and they tell their stories, or where they are, where they get support. So the older generation maybe gets support in terms of internet use or the use of a smartphone or so, mm-hmm. while the younger people know something or get to know something about the lives of and the experiences of older people. That's also something that that works and that happens, for example, in Salzburg. Intergenerational city walks, for example, are something that are organized in Salzburg. Or we have a project that is called Mini Salzburg. So this is for kids and youngsters, where the social workers or this organization and association builds Salzburg as in a mini way on a place or in a garden in Salzburg, and the young people can go there. They can get a ticket, and then they take different roles in the city. So they are they have elections. They can elect a mayor. Then they have different departments. They have a department for example, for urban gardening, or for helping people who need help, for all the different kinds that are also existing in the city. And that's a way how they learn to act in such an environment. So this is just another example, and there are many, many others, networks between schools and youth centers, for example, where youth associations offer role plays, one of these games would be the building of a constitution. This is called New State. So young people come together, and together with teachers and social workers, they discuss how a state could be developed, what a state would need as general rules, constitutional rules, and in which way people are represented, in which way people are elected, how long they may stay in office, and all these things, so that they get an idea of how democracy works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It reminds me a bit quite well-known book from Poland, which was written in the interwar period by a person called Janusz Korczak, and he's very well-known pedagogist in Poland, and this book is about the king Maciuś the First, and it's about a young child that becomes a king of the country.
Oh, yeah.
And uh-huh. explains actually precisely things what you are describing, how he changes also the situation in the states, where he puts in different places the stresses, the priorities, how he established the policies, and so on and so forth. Maybe before we will finish, I would like also to ask you maybe about some issues, some activities that maybe are missing according to your observation, and maybe if you can supplement those answers with showing, maybe if you have them, some examples from other countries that can be used to fix those gaps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that the problem is not so much that the ideas are missing or that methods are missing. We can always talk about improving the methods, of course, and that's important. And we can and should think about new methods. Like, for example, we are trying to develop a kind of political awareness training where people should reflect on their political self in a way that they are asked, for example, in which context of your life do you feel powerful? In which context of your life do you have a say? Or the other way around, in which context of your life do you feel manipulated or do you feel oppressed? And or another question, when did you start to think politically? Or what is the first souvenir that you have that has to do in any way with politics? And so by asking these questions and then discussing these questions, people start reflecting on their own political self, on their political biography, if you want. So this is something that should be fostered, in my opinion, to give a concrete example. But then the main problem is, I think, the systematic use of these different methods. So methods are there. There are good methods. There are good ideas and some new ones that need to be, that need to be established, that need to be evaluated. So I think it's very important to evaluate continuously what works and what doesn't work. But the most important thing would be a systematic use of these methods. And that's where I see the most important lack or the most important gap. And that has to do with the political, I think, authorities and priorities. And if there is no money and if there are no resources or if social workers are, as in so much cases, overcharged with all the different expectations, then they cannot dedicate their time to what is really important. And this is what we can see almost in all the fields of youth work, be it schools where teachers have the impression that they should do everything, that the whole world is putting their expectations on their shoulders. And the same thing is true for the social workers, I think. So they need resources, they need time and a budget to organize the things in a systematic way. And if this would be done, then they could really work in a way that would be very effective, I think. Other examples from other countries are important, and it is clear that some things are already very established in one country, others not. I'd like to maybe highlight one point, that is the networking between different actors. Like I see, for example, in Austria, we have a certain openness from the police to work together with social workers and the other way around. So social workers are ready to work with police and police is ready to work with social workers. Not always and not as it should be, but still there is something a start was made. This is still something that is absolutely unimaginable in many other countries, I think. I think it would be important to have this as well. And on the other side, of course, in Austria, many, many things are to learn from other countries, especially in our project, for example, if we have the different projects and methods to work with radicalized youth, then we can learn a lot from France and from Belgium. They have developed methods, counter speech or alternative speech. These debates, I think, are discussed also in Austria, but the projects are not so manifold as in France, for example. So yes, there is much to learn from different countries, and there are many interesting methods to use. The most important thing probably is the systematic use of these different methods.
Okay, Markus. So maybe let's finish this discussion with stressing the need to better recognition of the efforts that are being taken by those working on the ground, youth workers, educators, teachers, and also for fostering this especially cross-border exchange of expert and practitioners.
One thing comes to my mind. That's the framework, the framework of the competences from the Council of Europe. That should be mentioned maybe. This framework for competences of democratic culture is very important and is very sophisticated. It's very detailed, but it's not enough known, I think, in Austria. And I think it's important in the Austrian context to look at what is done in the Council of Europe and also in other countries. How can we make the indicators from the competence framework usable, and how can we work with them? So that would be, I think, an important question, not only in the school context, but as our project aims, especially in the context of social work.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and also we use it as a kind of guidelines also in our work in work of social workers as well, and preparing them to their work. Okay, Markus, thank you very much.
Thank you, Philip,
for sharing with us and for all this very interesting information and observations. And have a great day.
Yes, you as well. Thank you, Philip, for organizing this.